The PFL is live from Chicago, April 19th, with welterweights and featherweights taking center stage. In the main event, former Bellator welterweight champion Andrei Kereshkov takes on knockout artist Magomed Umalatov. And 2022 PFL world champion Brendan Loughnane looks to start his 2024 off with the bang versus submission specialist Pedro Carvalho. Don't miss the action. Friday, April 19th, live at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on ESPN and ESPN+.
What's up, guys? I'm Evan Turner, co-host of the Point Forward podcast, alongside Andre Iguodala. We got a special series out now, all about our favorite NBA cities, the greatest places to travel, the evolving cultures and cuisines, and some of our most memorable experiences while we were on the road during our many years in the NBA. We talk about Miami, Chicago, New York, and many more. Tune in to Courts and Culture, the Point Forward Travel Guide, sponsored by Hennessy. You can find it on Point Forward Feed on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Vox Media Podcast Network.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, we're live, pal. Wow, that's really loud. Hey, we're live, pal. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the A-Side Live Chat here on MMAFighting.com. I am, of course, your host, Jose Youngs, here in scorching hot Phoenix, Arizona. When I say hot, I don't think you can comprehend. It was about 118 yesterday. Don't come to Arizona ever if you want to live in the summer. And joining us, I'm happy to have him back after 2 years away. The last time you saw him on this program, he was the host. This was his show the last time he was on, and I was his final guest. I think we did like 2.5 hours on his last show, but joining us this week. Also, we wrote Phoenix, but I don't know technically where he is in Arizona. Sean Alshadi, the prodigal son, has returned. How's life?
My man, it is good to be back. Life is great. I mean, actually, life is terrible. You woke me. You got me doing this like an hour after this Chris Paul news. I can't.
Oh, yeah.
I can't handle this. Like, I'm on tilt right now. I'm just putting on a brave face for the world because I'm actually petrified of what's going on in my neck of the woods.
You could be a Clippers fan. You could be a Clippers fan. Just tell yourself that.
That would never be a thing. I don't know
why
that would
ever be. But at least
who's a Clippers fan?
I don't know. Is our old pal Dave Doyle a Clippers fan?
Doyle? Clipper.
One person.
Clipper fan, yeah. Who's a Clipper fan?
Yeah. I said
from
fan.
More than one.
Yeah, I said there is eight. They have, I think Billy Crystal's a fan, so they have two.
Yeah.
And they lost Kawhi Leonard until next year. Chris Paul can't come back.
True that.
What, that series is 2-2. Let's just pray it goes 7 games and Chris Paul gets all the time he needs. And then I hope the Clippers win now so the Suns don't have to play Rudy Gobert and that whole machine that is barreling through the Western Conference. But anyway, Casey.
Oh, bring on the Clippers. Or not 100%. The Clippers. Bring on the Jazz. Bring on the Jazz, man.
I'll take that
all day. Just give me Chris Paul healthy back. That's all I want. Like, this is our year. This is supposed to be the magical year where everything happens. I just bought like 3 different Suns and 4 gear merch yesterday. Like, we're going all in. We got to go all in. We need Chris Paul back.
If anyone sees Sean Alshadi in the wild, you have to yell Suns and 4 at him because that's his first name, apparently, as you can see on this lower third that Casey whipped up.
I try to put Sean Alshadi, and then it kept autocorrecting to Suns and 4. It's not my call.
There you go.
It's not my call.
But it is wonderful to be back here on this program, Jose. I remember, it was like yesterday where I brought you on, passed you the reins, and now it's all coming full circle, my man. It's good to be back.
Back in the day when the host was running pretty much all of the production and then the pandemic hit and Casey was like, nah, we're going to make it pretty. And I was like, please, thank God. Take it out of my hands. I can't handle all the technical issues. Sean, you missed I think it was like 2 months of chaos. Every single episode that I hosted for 2 months, something went wrong or something collapsed or something broke. And people remember. We don't have to talk about that. I'm the only journalist more cursed than Luke Thomas when it comes to technical issues. But Casey, I noticed you're in America.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm in America, living in America. Doing good. To be more specific, I'm in Inglewood, California, which is part of America. And we are a good 40 degrees cooler than you weirdos in living out in the desert in Arizona. So I'm smart.
I'm smart. Last week when the rest of our fellow media members were in Arizona, they were remarking how hot it was. And I was looking at the week ahead and I'd be like, you came at the perfect time. Because it was like 101 last week. And now today is a cool, balmy high of 117 for 3 days.
That's kind of when I remember when I was in Abu Dhabi for Habib versus Dustin. Oh. And it was like, 110. And we're like, oh, my God. And all the people at the hotel is like, oh, this is a cool week. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Dude, that's that Abu Dhabi weather, because I was there with you, Casey.
Oh, was that same event? Okay. I remember now. Yeah.
Jose, we live on the surface of the sun, but my man, I have never experienced heat to the degree that Abu Dhabi week was. That was the most insane thing I've ever experienced. Because it was the heat on top of the humidity, and it just punched you in the face the moment you stepped outside of the taxi. I got in at like midnight the first night, and I stepped outside the taxi, and I was wearing glasses because I was just coming from the airport, and my glasses instantly fogged up literally a half a second after being outside of the taxi. It was the most ridiculous welcome to Abu Dhabi experience.
Well, I spent 8 weeks in Abu Dhabi in the last 12 months. So by the seventh week, I was just like sitting outside on my balcony. I was like, this isn't so bad. And then I went back to Arizona and I was like, oh, this is what non-humidity, like my body completely acclimatized to Abu Dhabi by week seven. It was not great.
That's called Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah. Especially when you can only go from one hotel to another hotel to an arena. And that's literally just a triangle you can do. Oh, it was brutal. I remember I missed the bus and I had to go interview Israel Adesanya and the City Kickboxing Boys at their hotel, and I missed the shuttle. So I had all this camera gear and I ran. Poor decision.
Decision. That's a bad call.
Yeah, because I had to get there in like 5 minutes. So I ran and I get there and literally asked from and Gage was like, do you want another shirt? And I was like, probably, because I was so sweaty. Anyway,
Before we go on, I have one last weather-related factoid. Talking about how hot it was, there was a story on the Associated Press released about in Arizona in particular, doctors were warning people it is so hot outside that people are dying not from the heat, but they fall down and then they fry themselves on the asphalt.
It happens.
That's how freaking hot it is.
Is that real?
No, it was real. It was a story. But these doctors are warning. I think it's mostly for like older people. They don't want to have heat strokes going on walks because they'll fall down and they would die frying themselves on the street because the asphalt gets so hot.
Oh my God.
And so they're warning people just be extra careful. But I read that story and on Twitter, and then I left a comment. I go, ooh, grilling yourself to death, that's gotta suck. So I wrote that. It was like a little throwaway thing. I was like, oh, that sucks. And then like 5 minutes later, I get a notice from Twitter. I was put in Twitter jail for 12 hours because they said I was promoting suicide. I'm not joking. I was promoting suicide. Jeez. So if you haven't seen me on Twitter the last 12 hours, it was because I was in Twitter jail.
That's where you went. I was wondering why my Twitter feeds like got calmed down for a minute. Twitter is a strange place. I've learned this past weekend, as Sean knows, Twitter is a bizarre place, and there are corners of it that I did not expect whatsoever. As I open Twitter right now, and Diego Sanchez is tweeting about UFOs. Anyway,
you had a whole Justin Bieber civil war going on in your Twitter this weekend.
That was wild. You were kidding. I was like,
if anyone goes. And then I quote tweeted, I was like, y'all are nuts. And then I have like 1,000 apologies. Like, we apologize for the fan base. I was like, you're good, guys. You're fine. Stop tweeting at me. Please stop. I'm tired of the notifications. Dude, and everyone's like, oh, your Twitter note, you probably got a bunch of followers. Almost none. No one cares about MMA in the Bieber world. Anyway,
if people were going through your history, I saw like tweets from like 10 years ago. Like those.
Yeah.
That was you know, weird.
When you're like a shitty college kid and you're trying to just be kind of clever with your tweets. Yeah. So I threw one out there and everyone's digging it up. And then I was like, yeah, bro, that was 10 years ago. I was 20. I have no issue with Justin Bieber. Like, he's doing his thing. All power to him. And everyone's like, oh my God, he's one of us. I'm like, no, don't say that. Don't say that. None of us. I just have no issue with him. And it was, and then everyone got on our colleague Damon Martin too, because he was kind of like, he like caught the shrapnel because they took all of their rage and like directed it at him. It was a very bizarre scene. Twitter is a strange place.
Well, how weird is it also that MMA fans were all like, oh, Justin Bieber performed at the Jake Paul
Triller
event. Oh, and then a month later, the UFC, hey, look who's at our event, Justin Bieber. So that's amazing.
I just want to know what Justin Bieber was thinking of when he was driving through Glendale, Arizona. Past all the farms and everything. Anyway. You guys know the drill. We could talk about Justin Bieber. I know Sean can't for the next 60 minutes, but will I answer your questions as they come? You can ask on Twitter. Sean, I don't know if you know, but we're streaming on Twitter and Facebook now. So this isn't just a YouTube show.
Look at how this has grown up.
We're on Periscope and we're on Facebook Live. So Casey's man in the questions. We have a ton that came in on the site and through in the Twitter mentions. I'm sure more will come. I'm already seeing Suns in Four comments in the YouTube comments. So
Suns in Four, baby.
Keep that up. So keep it up. Anyway, Casey, what is our first question?
I'm interrupting you. I just have to say, I have watched that video about 40 different times at least. A couple of things. Most impressive part is just the fact that he's holding homeboy while talking to other homeboy and just telling him, 100%. I'm messing up your boy. Gets one more shot and then does the Suns and Four. The execution on that is just flawless. The chain hold, like you ain't getting away. Oh my God. I could deep dive this video for like an hour and a half, but I don't think anybody wants to hear that. But excellent. Just 10 out of 10. Like if there's a perfect video on the internet, it's that.
Dude. And that guy was such a punk. He was all trying to play it cool, and then he came in. Oh, he thought he was gonna be
crying.
Sucker punch.
Totally deserved it. And the fact that you know that he totally deserved it, because afterwards, Suns and Four King is out there doing the gladiator, are you not entertained type of situation in the arena, and none of the Nuggets fans are against him. They're all kind of for him and like fair on enough. That side. And it's like, yeah, those guys probably deserved it.
Fair play.
Fair play to you, guy. Anyway,
we done talking about Sprott's ball. You know,
Sprott's.
Can we talk about a real sport, mixed martial arts? Can we talk about that?
Let's see what you guys got. Hit us with these damn questions. Let's see what we got here.
It wouldn't be the ASAP if we didn't attend. From Waves, the Waves. Ooh. Coming in our Twitter section.
We got a blue check.
So shout out to Waves, great musician. Go check out his music. I think he had a new song come out this month or a new single, or they had a new single. Anyway, his question, can Paulo Costa be a babyface for the first time in his career if he fights Marvin Vettori next? So, yes, I don't know. We'll use this to set up a few things. Marvin Vettori, of course, came up short in his bid to dethrone UFC middleweight champion Israel Adesanya, UFC 263 this past week, and that was, of course, the second time they fought. I think for a split second, he convinced himself he won, especially inside the octagon, but if you watch the post-fight interviews backstage, he unfortunately didn't get to talk to us backstage at the press conferences, but he gave Israel Adesanya his props and respect after spending 8 rounds in the octagon with him, and then immediately called out the drunken border genius, a.k.a. Paulo Costa. Paulo Costa then tweeted, I will fight this idiot if he dresses like this. And it was a photo of Marvin Vettori wearing his shorts backwards. So Paulo Costa is a weird guy. Marvin Vettori is a weird guy. They're both angry, muscly men, and both have losses to Israel Adesanya. So, Sean, can Paulo Costa actually be a babyface against Marvin Vettori?
I mean, if he keeps coming up with Twitter responses like that, then it's possible. I didn't think that was a transition he would be able to make, but that's a 10 out of 10 right there. I like that one. This matchup is pretty great, man. I'm not going to lie. This isn't one that I ever considered, but just the idea of it and what it could be when it comes to the lead up and how these guys would talk to each other and how they would kind of just both be saying nonsense that doesn't really make sense, but getting each other more angry with that nonsense. And then they kind of there's a language barrier too here. Like all of it is really kind of very, very interesting to me. I'm here for this. Let's do this.
The trash talk, but both in their being in English being their second language is like, oh, yes, I love it so much.
But I think they wouldn't even understand what each other's saying, and they would just get more rage fueled off each other's rage, because they would know that somebody's saying something insulting to them.
And so kind of nice. Just would,
yeah, it's like, I don't know what you said, but I don't appreciate it. It would kind of just keep bouncing back and forth. I'm so here for that. Let's do that.
Well, I was on the official weigh-ins show. Mike Heck and AK were like, "Oh, that was a travesty of a press conference." And I was like, the most recent one with Marvin and Israel Adesanya. I was like, "Hell no!" If you were inside that venue, I don't remember what it's called now. It used to be the Comerica Theater. It was just chaos, and I couldn't hear anything they were yelling at each other. I just saw two men screaming. If they do media, I need Paulo and Marvin Vittori on stage together at some point yelling at each other. I don't want their first interaction to be a stare down. I need them in the same room talking all that greasiness. But I also like how Marvin lost and already had a name like right away. He's like, I want to fight Paulo next. I love that. I don't want to I'm going to take some time off, this and that. Nope, I want Paulo next. Let's get back into it. I love everything about this fight, and I hope it's next, and I hope Paulo and Dana can sort something out so we can see these two middleweights fight next.
I absolutely despise The Ultimate Fighter, except if Paulo Costa and Marvin Vittori can be the coaches. And they don't even need fighters, just two coaches of no fighters. I don't even care about the other whatever people in the show.
Hold on.
They just have to be roommates. Just put them in the house together and that's all.
I have an idea here. This is how you fix The Ultimate Fighter. This is the brilliant idea right here. Okay. You get Paulo Costa, you get Marvin Vittori. Case, you're totally right. No fighters at all. You just put them, they have to live in the house. They have to live in The Ultimate Fighter house together. And every day we do coaches challenges. That's it. That is the whole show. It's just coaches challenges. One day we're playing table tennis. One day we're running the hurdles. One day we're doing shot put, whatever. I just need to see these two in an enclosed environment, bouncing off of each other, talking trash that neither one understands, getting super upset, getting super competitive, and just doing the silliest obstacle courses in Pogs or Pokemon cards, whatever. Bring out the weird hobbies. Let's just get them in competitions every day against each other.
Episode 4, Costa versus Vittori, Sellers of Catan. The problem with Ultimate Fighter is actual fighting. We don't need the fighting part. We just need two angry dudes in a house and competing against each other and everything. Ugh.
That's it. We have enough.
I love you. Thank you.
I love you too, Casey. I love you too. We have enough fights. We have enough fighting. Yeah, let's just use The Ultimate Fighter as a way to promote people's personalities more and market them more, right? And who tell me who wouldn't watch this? Who's not in on this? Because I'm in on this.
I wish Marvin had a weird coach like Paulo Costa as Captain Eric, because then you can add a wild card into that situation, like two just goofy, over-the-top coaches. Because Rafael Cordero is pretty even keel.
Just bring in 1 second.
Vittori, bring in Sean Strickland. They train together.
Oh my god, that would be a nightmare.
I just discovered Sean Strickland's Instagram and it rules, by the way. I was on the fence about Sean Strickland. I was like, okay, now I'm all in. That guy's crazy. I love him. All right, we're good. Roll the credits.
It's the show. We fixed The Ultimate Fighter. What more can we do here? That's it. That was the A side. Thanks for coming, everyone.
All right.
Thank you for the question, Waves.
Thank you. Yeah, so that fight rules. Make it happen. And Costa is the baby face. All right.
Wow, this is a long one. All right. From Tristan Gordet on the MMA fighting site. You think Lauren Murphy will be Valentina's toughest challenge yet? Lauren thinks she can expose holes in Valentina's game, as she said in her interviews with Mike Heck, and believes that Valentina has never fought anyone as tough as her before. I know it's the fight game and anything can happen, but has Lauren even shown any indication during her win streak that makes you believe that she can go out there and present problems against Valentina? Many people thought Jessica Andrade would present problems as well, but look how that turned out. So yes, we'll use this as another way to set up this fight. Lauren Murphy beat JoJo Calderwood at UFC 263 in Glendale. I saw a lot of people saying JoAnn Calderwood won, or it was a controversial decision. I'm not going to lie. I was interviewing some fighters backstage, so I missed two of the three rounds. So I have no – I don't know if it's a bad call or not. I'll let you guys inform me. But that's 5 or 6 in a row for Lauren Murphy. She's being pretty much everyone put in front of her. She's the only one in the top 5, I believe, that hasn't fought Valentina. So she should be next. Even Valentina, after her win over Jessica Andrade, said she's going to be watching this fight. But then, of course, Dana White was like, oh, we're not going to make anything official yet. Lauren Murphy herself said in Media Day that she needs to go out there and have an impressive performance to get the shot. She can't go out there and stare at JoJo for three rounds, pick up a decision win, and then get the title shot. I don't know if that's how the fight played out, because, again, I missed two of the three rounds. I can't remember who was talking but backstage, but I missed a chunk of it. So, Sean, I'll start with you. I'll ask two questions. A, did you score this fight for Lauren Murphy? And B, should she get the next shot at Valentina Shevchenko?
Well, it's funny because I was actually backstage right next to you. So I was also interviewing fighters and doing that sort of thing. But I tried to catch most of it because this was a very important fight for the card. And I scored it for Lauren. It was obviously very, very close. It felt like you could go either way on this 29-28 either way. I did give it to Lauren, though. And honestly, man, she deserves it. I think it's very typical Dana that he obviously wouldn't say that on fight night. He's got a lot going on, but there's nobody else in the division. There isn't really an option at this point. And maybe it's not, you know, the matchup that lights, you know, the division on fire or headlines a pay-per-view, but it's the matchup that needs to happen. And ultimately, sometimes we just need to get through these type of fights. There's no one left at 125 that's going to be anything less than a 15-1 dog or like a 13-1 dog against Valentina Shevchenko. This is kind of the reality that we're dealing with right now, unless we can get some new blood in this division. And Lauren Murphy has earned it, man. Like, she really has. Like, I am incredibly impressed with what Lauren Murphy has done in this turnaround that she's had over the last couple of years. She's someone who started her UFC career, 2-4, 2-5, yeah. 2-4, I believe. And ever since then, she's totally turned it around, 5 straight wins, and she's the underdog in almost all of these different wins. And it's just so impressive to see someone this late in their career really grit it out and kind of have this magical late chapter. I'm just happy, if nothing else, that she's going to get a big spot and a big payday before she's able to call it quits on her career. I don't know that I would go out and pick her to win this fight, obviously, but I think she's earned it, and I think it's a good matchup.
Casey, is there any other fight for Lauren Murphy to take next? I can think of one, and it's a big maybe, but is there any other fight for Lauren Murphy after that, unless it's Valentina?
There's no reason she should take another fight. The whole kind of premise, I've seen this a lot, this out there. Oh, you know, Lauren Murphy's going to get smashed with Valentina, whatever, blah, blah, blah. She wants to fight Valentina, blah, blah, you know. It's like, I don't care. It's like, it doesn't matter. The champ is the best for a reason. That's why they're the champ. Everyone should be an underdog fighting the champ. So that's, I mean, I don't, just because you're going to get ass kicked by the champ, Lauren Murphy has earned her opportunity to get her ass kicked by Valentina Shevchenko. It is an honor to get your ass kicked by Valentina Shevchenko. That's what you do in this sport. You work your way up to get eventually beat up by Valentina Shevchenko. That's how it works. I don't understand, like, she's not ready. She's a number one contender. She has earned this spot. What was the actual question?
I was just you're totally right. She's 37. Like, she's not ready. She's more ready now than she's ever going to be. Like, is Valentina Shevchenko just not supposed to fight until we find somebody who can potentially beat her? Like, this is just how it happens. DJ was out here. This is how DJ racked up the most title defenses in UFC history. Like, you just give the next person in line the opportunity, and maybe sometimes you'll get a TJ Dillashaw head and brow out of it. Exactly. That you're like, oh my God, we didn't see this coming.
Nobody's ready till they are. I don't know how to say it. Like, Chris Weidman wasn't ready for Anderson Silva, you know, then he won. You know, Holly Holm wasn't ready for Ronda Rousey, then she won. I can do this over and over forever. But I just think it's at least that premise. But
there literally is no other option. Like, here is the top five right here. Jessica Andrade, Caitlin Chukagian, Lauren Murphy, Jennifer Maia, and Valentina Shevchenko, obviously. Like, everybody else has fought. Lauren Murphy is the person. There's no one left. There's no other options.
Would anyone be surprised if the UFC booked her to welcome Tatiana Suarez to the flyweight division?
I would be disappointed.
I wouldn't be surprised. Because Tatiana's already said. I want, like, Lauren should fight Valentina next. I 100% agree with that. But Tatiana Suarez has said she wants to come back at 125. Everyone kind of assumed it would be against Caitlin Chukagian because she's been kind of the one to welcome the strawweights coming up to flyweight. But if Dana White, for whatever reason, doesn't want Lauren Murphy to fight Valentina next, and he wants Tatiana Suarez to fight her next because he wants her, he views her as a more marketable fighter, give her the number one contender. And if Lauren Murphy beats Tatiana, then give her Valentina. If Tatiana beats Lauren Murphy, then give her Valentina, whatever. Don't think it should happen, but I wouldn't be surprised.
I'll tell you why it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen because the UFC needs title fights. And right now, every Valentina title fight is at least a title fight on the card that they can throw up there. They're not going to just sit around with Valentina. Like, she's ready to go. She's ready to go fight. If she wants to get on a card, they're going to just throw her against whoever the best possible option is. And right now, that's Lauren Murphy. They're not going to wait, you know, hey, Valentina, we're going to have a contender for you in 5 months. Just chill out for a second. Like, that's how the UFC operates. They're just going to keep the train moving.
And the Suarez thing, I don't think works either because we have the injury possibility. Tatiana hasn't actually competed. So what, they build up this big fight and then Tatiana gets injured? You know, her neck goes out again. And then you're back to Lauren Murphy again on short notice or something. To me, like, she ain't ready or whatever. Marvin Vettori wasn't ready for Israel Adesanya. Yeah, we didn't have an issue with the main eventing in Glendale last week. It was fine. Yeah, Murphy's earned her shot. I don't get it.
It is what it is. Yeah, it is what it is.
She's earned it, and I mean, we can talk in who's going to win, blah, 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 this, blah, blah, that. You know, of course, Valentina's going to be the heavy favorite. But you know what? No one's rolled through. People have beaten Lauren Murphy, but no one's rolled through her. No one's rolled
Lauren Murphy. Lauren Murphy looks her opponents look real bad, and I think that's a skill in MMA.
Yeah, and that's the kind of issue of Lauren Murphy is like, in her fights, like no one looks really good or really bad. It just kind of happened. Like JoJo didn't get exposed or didn't look great and robbed or anything. It's just, you know, we kind of come out feeling the same about him, essentially. That's kind of the issue of Lauren Murphy. It's not her fault, but she just hasn't, like if she wouldn't have finished JoJo in 45 seconds on the ground and pound or whatever, does our opinions change at all? It's just we're in the same situation. You know, it's like someone has to fight Valentina. Lauren Murphy got the judge's decision, so she's next.
Make it happen.
Next question.
Thank you for the question, Tristan. Daniel Pompilio on Twitter. How about Aaron Pico killing it in Bellator? Looks like Coker is not trying to ruin him anymore. When will it be ready for the top five, and what do you think about Clarissa Shields' debut at PFL? So two questions. Aaron Pico, of course, emerged victorious. It was Bellator 260, correct? That was the number on Friday?
Yeah.
How many wins in a row is that for Aaron Pico?
That is four in a row now.
Four or five. Yeah,
that's four in a row since his most recent was his knockout loss to Borch, right? Borch, who in turn has emerged as one of the best featherweights on planet Earth.
Yeah.
And then before that, it was a knockout loss to Henry Corrales again, and who's now 135, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Hard hitting guy, and Pico was winning that fight until he got punched in the face really hard. So, Casey, I'll start with you. What do you make of Aaron Pico's chances at a run at the title? I know the title's kind of up in the air right now with the Pitbull McKee fight that still has to happen. But what do you make of Aaron Pico's recent run in Bellator?
Just listen to Aaron's interviews. He lays it out pretty well. When he came into this sport, he was a great wrestler. He was a great striker, but he did not know how to fight mixed martial arts. That's all. I mean, that's about it. He took his losses. He learned from them. So after the Corrales loss, which I think was his wind up being a second loss of his career.
Yeah, second. Yeah. His first fight in Bellator was his first loss.
Yeah, well, that was his first 145 loss. I'll go with that. And he changed management. He changed his complete. He completely moved from Southern California to Albuquerque. He got under the tutelage of Greg Jackson and Brandon Gibson. And it's just a perfect fit for him. And so, yeah. And everything those guys say about him, like, they tell me off the record, too, the same exact thing. Like, Aaron's the real deal. He works his ass off. He's freaking talented. He's a great athlete. And he loves mixed martial arts. And, And right now, the second part of the question is Coker not trying to ruin him anymore. This actually goes back to Pico's management, which he did change. Now he had a different manager before. I'm not sure who it was. Now he's under Ali. So I think Ali's handling him better now. And but Pico wants those challenges. He called for Borch. And now he's having an issue with these guys not wanting to fight him. So Aaron Pico is just must-see TV. I don't know if he'll win the belt. I think he's talented enough to. He's must see TV. I'm just excited to see him. If he fights anyone, I think everyone just has to see Aaron Pico fight. He's just just one of the most exciting featherweights in the world, without a doubt.
Sean, we were watching this while we were waiting for our COVID results on Friday. What did you make of Aaron Pico's performance at Bellator 260?
It's impressive, man. It really is impressive what this kid has. I hate to say kid, too. I sound like Dana White when I do that. What this guy is turning into, man. I mean, he's 24. Only 24.
He's 24. You can call him a kid.
He's 24 years old, though. That's the thing. Like, he's been in our lives for 4 or 5 years at this point? Like, we were hearing about him, 5 years ago, articles were being written about he was the greatest prospect of all time. Like, that is a lot of baggage to come into the sport with and try to uphold that as you're navigating your way in this brand-new thing you've never done. He's really found himself, man. And like you mentioned, Casey, the team that he's put around him now between his management and what's going on at Jackson Wink, it really feels as if he's sort of found his place in the sport, kind of found what's going to be most helpful for him, his processes and just the people around him seem to be very much managing it in a way that is more beneficial to a prospect rather than the way we saw it early on, where it's just like, hey, it's his first fight. Let's throw him in against Zach Freeman. On this huge spot, that's not a great
lightweight
idea. There was a lot of mistakes at the beginning, but at this point he is a monster, man. Like you really, like, when you watched those fights, it feels as if the guy he is fighting is in omnipresent danger at all times of just being really brutally ended in like a ferocious highlight reel fashion. I'm here for it. I'm really excited about what he's turning into, and we're about to get this AJ McKee Pitbull fight up in Bellator, which is one of my most anticipated fights of the year. Like, for the featherweight title, like, that is everything that you could possibly hope for Bellator, two homegrown products really meeting at the perfect moment. But Aaron Pico is very quietly laying in the background right here in this featherweight division. And if I don't know if he's ready for that, but I don't think he's very far off either. And the idea of Aaron Pico against either of those dudes is one that I hadn't allowed myself to really start entertaining up until this last one, Jose, when we were watching this last fight, because it just does feel as if he is starting to be a fully complete fighter, not even approaching his final form, but at least approaching that level where he is starting to be able to take on these actual top level guys in this sport. And it is very exciting to me.
Yeah. If AJ beats Pitbull, I would imagine AJ is going to want to fight for Pitbull's lightweight belt too. Yeah. So he can become a champ. But AJ McKee versus Aaron Pico has a lot of storylines that would go into that. They used to train together. Pico and AJ were like the golden children of Bellator for a long time, coming up in Antonio McKee's gym. Pico left. And Casey, remember when we went to that Bellator media day in California, we were asking AJ about all the other featherweights, and he was kind of doing his thing, kind of talking all this greasiness. And then we brought up Pico and he got real serious. He's like, "That's my brother, but I'm not going to say anything right now." And you could tell he was holding a little back. Like, maybe he seemed upset that Aaron left. And then we asked Aaron if he wanted to go join the tournament, because remember, AJ hurt his knee and right before the pandemic, and the pandemic let him come back. And at that Dominus media day, we brought up, like, Aaron, do you want to join the tournament? He's like, "No, I don't." And then he started to ask specifically about AJ's knee. So there's a lot of storylines in there. But I'm not going to say no to Aaron Pico Pitbull either, because that fight rules too.
Yeah, I personally don't feel Pico and McKee will ever fight. I think McKee will go up to 55. McKee's even insinuated his body's going to outgrow 45. He'll go to 55 soon. Yeah. So, and as much as I want to see that fight, I kind of don't want to see it, because it kind of feels gross in a sense, because it kind of feels like brothers fighting, you know. And while that's
like, what was Sean? Who's the remember World Series of Fighting?
The Phoenix guy,
Phoenix Jones fought his brother. Yeah. That was all kinds of terrible. All kinds of terrible.
They kind of sound fun in theory, but when you see it, I don't know, for a big bag of money, it just feels weird. But
well, they also had a lot of like family issues come to the surface leading up to that fight.
The PFL is live from Chicago, April 19th, with welterweights and featherweights taking center stage. In the main event, former Bellator welterweight champion Andrei Koreshkov takes on knockout artist Magomed Umalatov. And 2022 PFL world champion Brendan Loughnane looks to start his 2024 off with the bang versus submission specialist Pedro Carvalho. Don't miss the action. Friday, April 19th, live at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on ESPN and ESPN+.
The 82-game preseason is in the books, and it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code SMASH. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code SMASH, only on DraftKings. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 and over, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources,
which no one needed anyway. The second part of the question: what did you guys make of Cliff Shields' debut in PFL? Sean, I'll start with you.
I was conflicted because obviously it was super impressive. Just the base fact of what she was able to do, I think, was incredibly impressive. Right, like you're going into your MMA debut, something you've never done. For some reason, you're facing a brown belt in jiu-jitsu who's primarily a grappler, like a long, rangy person, too, who can kind of keep you at bay with front kicks a little bit. It was a very weird matchmaking, and that was, I guess, maybe where I didn't enjoy that aspect of it. Because to me, like, I'm a guy who grew up in Pride, right? Like, I grew up watching the Pride style of matchmaking, and if this was Pride, you throw her in with, like, an overweight pro wrestler or, like, this half-retired kickboxer, and she comes in, destroys the woman, and you have this highlight reel that you can just put on over and over again, and she looks like a monster. And that's the way you do the MMA debut, and everybody comes away from it really impressed. That obviously wasn't this, but it was still really impressive to just see her really just grit this out and pull off this come-from-behind win. It felt like poor Brittany Elkin was really fading really hard and feeling the stress of the moment and the weight of the moment there in that third round. But I was incredibly impressed, man. I mean, Clarissa Shields is still very far off from being any sort of a finished product. And the idea that Dana White was toying with a year or two ago about throwing her in there with Amanda Nunes, I'm actually very glad now that that didn't come to fruition, because that wouldn't have been good for anybody except for Amanda Nunes. But she is impressive, man. She is really impressive. I don't know that she's going to be able to have time and the dedication to really make a true, true run of it here in MMA and really become who she would have been if she had committed only to MMA. But I'm really interested to see how far she can take this and how far she wants to take this. Because that was, I mean, you can't knock what she did in her debut. That was really, really impressive.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the, I don't know if she's going to have time, because how long has she been at Jackson's? Like a couple, like a while now, right? Like training MMA?
Less than 6 months.
Not a while, not a long time, but yeah. Like.
Less than just months. Just months.
She's had a boxing match during her time at Jackson's, yeah. Right? Like in the middle of training for MMA. Yeah. So if she's trying to do both, it's going to be hard for her to. No,
she's doing the Izzy. She's actually doing the Izzy.
I understand.
Izzy was a high level kickboxer.
I know.
Also
I understand.
Training MMA on the DL.
I understand, but Izzy wasn't also all of a sudden thrown into like this prime time spot on ESPN for his debut.
Yeah, Izzy was able to lay low. Like, we're going to be hyper analyzing every step she takes.
And Clarissa, to her, and I like this, what one of her phrases where she could quit boxing. She said for like a whole year, she could take a whole year off. I can't remember who she said this to, but I saw the clip. She could take a whole year off of just training and still go in there and beat everyone in her division of women's boxing. She said that's how much better she is at boxing. So I think she is going to jump into MMA a little bit more, but it was a weird fight for me. Cause I think, her opponent, who was a brown belt, had like her arm at one point. She had double grips at one point. Like if she just kind of hit the Kimura, she could have probably got that, but weird fight. But we saw a lot from Clarissa Shields. Casey, what are your thoughts?
I'm going to disagree big time with Shaheen. You said that was a weird matchup. I completely disagree. She was a handpicked opponent on purpose, because I've known Greg Jackson for a while. If they would have, say, picked, oh, let's pick another boxer going into MMA, and say Clarissa Shields knocks her out in 15 seconds, 30 seconds. From Greg's point of view, from the coach's point of view, that means they learn zero from that. That means Clarissa actually gets no experience. She goes, okay, I just did a boxing match with small gloves. By facing this opponent She felt the pressure, main event, but an opponent that would give her a hard time, but somehow she would have to fight through and win the fight. One of Greg's golden rules is what he coaches: be comfortable being uncomfortable. And that's what I saw in Clarissa Shields. When she was put in bad positions, she did not freak out. She did not just like hump and like try to buck out and use all her energy and just burn her arms out in the first 30 seconds, which you know, essentially every white belt does. She didn't fight like a white belt. She fought like an experienced white belt in the sense that she didn't have
a couple stripes. She got a couple stripes.
A two-stripe white belt. In the sense that she didn't burn herself out, but she also recognized that, okay, I'm in a bad position. It's okay. I'm in a bad position. It's okay. And that's such a giant thing for a fighter to learn. So from the coach's point of view, from Shields' point of view, while, yeah, you didn't get that 10-second highlight knockout, I think you got something so much better for the long term of her career. And also, look back in fighters' careers in general, the great fighters, their first fights I'm probably weren't that impressive. Either they knock him out in 30 seconds, but you don't just learn. Dude, DC's first fight, when he fought at this – his first fight was televised on Showtime, I think, for Strikeforce on a Show XC fight.
Oh, yeah.
He fought some rando dude, like a 3-0 heavyweight, and it was an ugly 15 minutes. And I remember watching, it was like, all right. And then – but he needed that. So I thought it was a great performance. I thought it was a great debut. And while it wasn't the big knockout we were hoping for, I think we got something better. That's all.
I don't know what you're talking about with DC, because he fought Gary Frazier and he ended up destroying the dude in like 8 minutes. And it was super ugly.
Did he finish Gary Frazier? Okay, maybe he finished him, yeah. But yeah.
He was super, super ugly, because I did this big thing on DC.
It was ugly, though. You didn't go, that's one of the greatest fighters ever. You weren't thinking that. You were like, okay.
No. No. It was a very ugly, ugly fight. And I totally understand where you're coming from on this, Casey, and I actually appreciate and agree with a lot of what you're saying. I just think for the debut, like for the second fight, this would have been a perfect second fight to me. Like for the debut, I think you just get somebody out there and you get the highlight and you get the confidence just rolling of like, okay, we're doing this. This is working. And then we can sort of start navigating the problems and the holes and things like that. I just think for the first fight with everybody tuning in, it's such a big deal. You took a risk. You took a huge risk. Like if you did this fight 10 times, she might have lost 5 of them. And that would have been a really, at least if you're PFL, that's a nightmare scenario, right? Like you really went all in on this. But they avoided it. And I think everybody comes out of it looking good. So you can't complain about it.
You definitely saw her white belt, as Casey said, on display. When I think her opponent got full mount and Clarissa was trying to box off of her back a few times, and then like she snapped out of it immediately. Like it was just like it's instinct.
That, yeah, like it's you're the like, oh, like, the oh crap.
And then like, yeah. And then she like calms down. Yeah. And then, but there were like, you could definitely tell she's got a lot to learn, but a win is a win. And she came back and won. So kudos to her.
And coming back from adversity is a big freaking thing in this sport. Coming back from adversity. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've always said that, like, yeah, we know a fighter can kick someone's ass, but once they're kind of behind, how do they do?
Yeah.
Are they a front runner? Let's pump.
Clarissa Shields could have very easily given up on herself in that third round and been like, man, this was a terrible idea and I'm looking awful on national television right now. But she didn't. She's a champion. She's a two-time freaking gold medalist. Like she's got it in her that none of us have inside of us. So
she had that Brandon Moreno type joy when she won her debut. Yeah. And I thought that was just as a fan, that just feels good to watch. That's all.
Yeah, you know, it does.
Fans in my Twitter mentions, let's pump the brakes on Clarissa Shields versus Kayla Harrison. That's not happening anytime soon.
No.
I'm just talking about people. I tweeted about it. People were tweeting at me. I'm like, I don't want to see that at any point in the next 12 months. Anyway, thank you for the question. Back-to-back non-UFC questions from Daniel Pompilio.
Right. Do.
MMA, what's from Azan Zaman on the site? What's next for Chase Hooper? Every fight looks like a tough fight for him. Jose, tell us an Arizona Mazzagatti story. The Arizona crowd was horrible.
My God.
So I'm going to start with the second. I don't think the Arizona crowd was – like they booed. Like I was disappointed a few times, but I don't think they were horrible.
Okay. I'm jumping it. Okay. We're both Arizona guys. We both have grown up in Arizona. We can acknowledge when Arizona sucks more so than anybody else.
No, in the I agree. Media, so right? Like, I was going to bring up, remember when the UFC card was in Phoenix for Kane Francis? That was a horrible crowd because they were doing the wave like during the Cynthia Calvillo, Courtney Casey fight. Like that was a horrible crowd.
I like that the wave is your barometer for a horrible crowd. Like that's the first thing that pops in your head is they were the wave and you can't do the wave.
If you're doing the wave during a fist fight, nothing's happening in the fist fight, and it's just. No. But I think that crowd was more horrible. I think that the Phoenix crowd was more horrible than the Glendale crowd.
This was an atrocious crowd. I could say that because I live here. It was one of the worst crowds. It was the worst crowd we've seen in the post pandemic sort of comeback that we've been doing here by far. And considering the places they've gone, that I'm ashamed to be able to say that. Let's just say that. How's Florida beating you out, guys? If you're in here booing every single second that somebody's hitting the ground, you're out here booing Damian Maia in his retirement fight, essentially, from the UFC for no reason, just because he's doing Damian Maia stuff. Like, come on, guys. Come on. You have to be better than that. Everybody is watching you just be crappy from the first fight on. Like it was instant. I don't remember which fight it was, but it was one of the early fights where just like stuff was kind of stalled for like a couple seconds. And it was just like at that point on, the boo birds were all out in full force for the rest of the event. It's just like, guys, groundwork is part of the game. Like, what are we doing? We're not even booing boring groundwork. We're just booing all groundwork at this point. It was terrible. It was terrible. And the fact that you can't admit that, Jose, shows me that you're just... You're just a little too biased, my friend.
Well, here's the thing I was going to say at the end of my ramblings. I was out in the lower bowl for the first fight because there was no one backstage to interview. And then the last three fights, and everything else, I was backstage. So if you were out earlier than me, you definitely got a better sense of the crowd than me. Because I was out there for Diaz Leon Edwards, which was pretty raucous at times. The Brandon Moreno fight, which I couldn't hear myself after that fight ended, I was there for the three big fights. Other than that, I was backstage. So I will defer to you for the crowd thing. But what I saw wasn't as bad.
I will say the crowd was incredible for Moreno because they were behind 100%. Moreno all week. There's a huge Mexican, population here in Arizona, and there was a huge, like the amount of support that was there for Brandon Moreno that night was unreal. There were Mexican flags all over the place, and when he won, we said it on the post fight show, but that truly felt like a magical moment. Like that's a moment I am not going to ever forget. Like I have been in the arena for a lot of different fights and a lot of different crazy outcomes, but there are very few moments you could count them on a couple of hands where it's just like, I will remember that for the rest of my life. And that was definitely one of them because that was just unreal. The emotion in that arena was crazy.
It was the very first fight of the night between Felipe and Collier. I didn't think that was that bad of a fight. I thought it was just kind of two heavyweights just throwing punches at each other for 15 minutes. I was entertained. And the crowd in the lower bowl was very much into it. But there was one fan who was louder than all of the other fans. And the second it got past the 3 minutes, I could tell that he bet that this fight would end in under 3 minutes because he yelled boring at the top of his lungs for 2.5 rounds. And then a bunch of other fans, not with him, all tried to fight him because this fight ruled and this guy was yelling boring. And a bunch of people went and confronted this rude fan. So I had three epic crowds and then a bunch of fans defending bad heavyweight MMA. So it was a weird scene. But anyway, Sean, do you have any Arizona Mazzagatti stories you want to share?
Oh my God, this guy.
So we're talking about the ref that did the Hill Craig fight, right?
Correct. His name is Al Guinea. He's been in, I don't know how many regional shows you used to go to back in the day, Jose, like a lot of Rage in the Cage and stuff. I went to a lot of those shows. Like growing up, I just loved MMA and there was a ton of promotions around, in particular Rage in the Cage. So I would always just go to these Rage in the Cage shows. Al Guinea has been an Arizona referee for a long, long time. And the first time I ever saw him referee a regional show, I can't remember the exact situation. I can't remember the exact fight and circumstance of what happened. So I'm not going to say something because I don't want it to be incorrect, but I just remember that he really badly screwed up something to where it was just like, you're in the crowd, you're watching, you're like, dude, that's the most obvious thing. Like, how did you mess that up? And it's a show that eight people are at and no one's paying attention to and everyone's drinking. So it's like, it's easy to lose and it leaves your mind. But I can't at this point count the number of times I've seen that guy just make simple, ridiculous mistakes on these regional shows. It's a lot. It's more than two hands. Like I could count it on more than two hands. And yet every single time that a big event or a big promotion comes to Arizona, somehow he finds his way onto these assignments and he gets sometimes some of the biggest assignments. And I was going through my Twitter history because I was like, I'm sure that I've sent this tweet before of like, Al Guinea is a local, because like every time this happens, people turn to like people like me and you, Jose, where it's like, it's Arizona. What's going on with this guy? And I was like, I'm sure that I've sent a tweet out before of like, oh, this is Al Guinea. He's a local. He's not very good. And literally there was like at least one or two different tweets that were basically the exact same tweet that I sent out on Saturday that I had sent out like years ago, like a couple years ago. And then a couple years before that, it's just like, it's a consistent thing that happens every couple of years is the big shows come to this place. Al Guinea gets a fight. Al Guinea messes up a fight. And then everybody's like, oh, why was that guy out there? I don't understand how this keeps happening. The fact that that one was as bad as it was, like I've never seen an arm do that. And then the fight just kept going for like another, 10, 15 seconds after the arms kind of just flopping around. Like Al Guinea's supposed to be a black belt. I don't really know how you screw that up. Regardless, I wish that the Arizona Commission would not put these local referees on these shows. That's all I ask. Like, just bring in the big guys like most other commissions do. It doesn't make sense that you just decide that, hey, this is our chance to give this guy some run. It's not. It's not your chance to give this guy some run. Make us look good for the rest of the world, please.
Make us look good by making sure no one from here is actually responsible for anything going on.
For real, man.
I even remember when we would go to those World Series of Fighting shows, Sean, and he would be like part of the World Series of Fighting. You're like, oh crap, something terrible is about to happen right now. But yeah, Arizona Mazzagatti is a funny nickname.
Can I defend, what's his name, Ray Guinea?
Al Guinea. Okay.
Ray Jennings. Ray Jennings.
Oh, I gotta defend Ray Jennings here. I'll say this. It was a weird non-stoppage, but there has to be some responsibility on Jamal Hill too. It's like, because the way the rules are set. So say if Mr. Guinea sees what's going on, but he sees that Jamal Hill is still fighting his way out and stuff. The problem is if he stops that fight, go, hey, man, is something wrong with your arm? And it just turns out there's something not wrong with his arm. It just turns out, well, you know, I'm just swinging crazy. Then the fight's over, though. I'm just saying the fight's over. There's no, like, let me check on it. Okay, continue. That's what I'm saying. Like, so that's – and we would hate that. We would hate for that to happen. Then we'd go like, oh, Ray Jenny. Al Guinea, you know, he sucks as a ref. I can't believe he stopped that fight on an early stoppage. Because we've seen that before. You know, refs think the guys are out, and it turns out, no, that this is how you – I'm just relaxing because – you know, I'm just in a submission. The choke's not in. I think, what's his name? Chas Skelly was a kind of a classic example of that. So I want to give the ref a little bit of a leeway in that sense. And also Jamal Hill, if his arm is broken or dislocated, that's on him. He needs it. He has another arm. He can quit fighting. You know, he can tap out. So I'll just say that.
And that's totally fair. That is absolutely fair. Everyone makes mistakes. That's an incredibly difficult job. I couldn't do that job. I would never act like I could do that job. But I think it's just more of like
a long time. He's out of history.
It's like you had a lot of moments. Yeah. If this was an isolated incident, Ray Jennings, where it's just like this is the only time that Ray has ever screwed up, right, then like, okay, like we can just move on with this. But Ray Jennings has consistently screwed up his entire time I've ever, like the hit percentage on Ray Jennings fights that I've watched refereed where he screws up is like 75%. And at that point, it's just like, if I'm expecting you to mess up, And I can come away from a fight like, oh, wow, I can't believe Ray didn't mess up that fight. Like, that's not a place we need to be with the referee. We shouldn't be surprised that you did your job okay. That's all I'm saying.
The next time Al Guinea fights, refs, he has a fake mustache on, and he's like, this is Ray. I'm Ray Jennings reporting for work. Anyway, the first question Mr. Zaman asked, what's next for Chase Hooper? Casey,
that's a good one. Casey, anyone? Go for it.
Well, he's only on a one fight losing streak. The fight was competitive. He's 21 years old.
His opponent missed weight.
Your opponent missed weight. you book Chase Hooper against the worst featherweight you have. That's all. He just, whatever number 30 is in the UFC rankings, you have Chase Hooper fight number 35. That's all.
And, or you bring somebody in, to be honest. Like you bring somebody else in to who is that guy, right? Who is the number 35? Because I'll tell you what, I know what you're saying. Like, but Jose, I think you would agree with me. Like, I was stunned Chase Hooper was getting all week.
It was nuts. Like, I thought when he
was getting treated like a star. Like
when he came out for weigh-ins,
loved him.
When he came out for wins and I heard the crowd, I had to, in my mind, I'm like, is he from, I know he's not from Arizona, but does he have ties to this place? Because after Nate and Izzy and Brandon Moreno, Chase Hooper had the biggest pop. And I had to research why. And I couldn't figure out why outside of he's just a popular fighter.
Yeah, he's just over with the fan base, to use a pro wrestling parlance, like at least to a degree that I didn't expect. Like that was, yeah. So normally I would say, you know, you're kind of in a situation where you're just in the UFC, you're stuck. You kind of have to sink or swim here, but he does have some heat behind him and he seems to have a following. So if I'm the UFC, I'm trying to nurture that a little bit. I'm trying to bring in guys that maybe there'll be competitive fights, but Chase can beat him because he is a flawed fighter right now.
Of course.
He's very, very young.
21.
He's very extraordinarily young. He probably shouldn't even be in the UFC.
He did an interview with Mike Heck and he said, he goes, well, I might have to go to 55 once I get through puberty. The dude's still in puberty.
I mean, he's joking around.
I know, but I don't know.
If you're the UFC, you kind of have something here. And so you have to nurture it a little bit. It's going to take time. Like, I don't think we're talking about Chase Hooper being a fully, even coming close to a complete fighter for 3 years, right? Like, in 3 years, he's going to be Aaron Pico's age. And we're still talking about Aaron Pico like he's still a work in progress. So it's going to be a while. I don't know how they're going to have this many guys to give him competitive fights in the meantime, but that's kind of the move you have to do because he does have some genuine popularity and heat and following behind him that at least surprised me.
And Hooper's a tough – Hooper, I mean, despite his looks, the dude's a fighter. He takes a beating and he fights through – he goes through adversity. He doesn't hit the first shot. Oh, can't get the heel hook. Oh, this sucks. I quit. That's not him. He is a fighter. He is a tough dude. He's 21. And since he's not like a natural athlete, he's not going to – he has to win fights on actual technical skill. And he's only 21. It takes years to develop all that technical skill if you don't just have that natural, crazy athleticism. He just doesn't, you know. But
My biggest worry goes exactly to what you just said. He kind of is winning fights on toughness right now. That is not a good – that's not a good quality when you're 30, and that's an even worse quality when you're 21. Like, if you're consistently – if every fight's gonna kind of follow a rhythm of I'm gonna get the shit kicked out of me until somebody gets tired and then I can kind of Homer Simpson them on the ground, like, man, that's not what you should be doing when you're 21 and 22. Like, that's gonna add up fast. Like, that's how you get to sort of those Rory McDonald Shogun age where you're like 30 but you kind of look like you're 39, that type of thing. Like, I don't know, man. I really hope that he can avoid that sort of road and path for his career, because that's not good for anybody.
And you brought up Casey, it's only a one fight losing streak. He was about 2 minutes away from losing to Peter Barrett before he got that heel hook on, because that was the fight. Do you remember Joe Rogan for two rounds said Chase Hooper doesn't belong in the UFC, and then he got that heel hook 3 minutes into the final round. And then we brought up Dana White, and Dana was like, yeah, he's just a tough kid. And I was like, that's toughness only gets you so far. Also, he fought Alex Saris, who has what, 30-something fights. Steve Peterson also has 30-something fights. They have more professional fights than Chase Hooper has years on this planet. So maybe don't give him a veteran who has gone a lot of losses, a lot of wins, a lot of losses. Like, as Casey and I have said on the show a lot of times, sometimes that just comes with experience. Like, there's certain moments in a fight. That's just an experience factor right there. So let's give him someone that's, you know.
But I do – my big worry about fight. Chase Hooper is if he doesn't get matched up properly, even if he loses fights, that's fine. But if he just takes horrible beatings in these losses, by the time he's 23, his mixed martial arts career, professional career, may be over. And that just sucks. Yeah. So you just got to be very – because this isn't like regular sports. So once you're kind of done, there's very rarely do you come back. You know,
there's no fountain of youth you're finding. Yeah.
Yeah. So just be very careful. Like, this is when I wish we had more boxing type matchmaking, where I would have Hooper face bantam weights for the next five fights. You know, but I know UFC just doesn't do that, so that's their thing. Whatever.
But, who is that? Who is that UFC fighter that has the? I think he has the New Mexico flag, Casey, and he's also super young, and he had like three UFC fights and
yeah,
like 7 months.
Name, yeah,
and he's 0-3 already. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I don't want that to happen.
I think a name I think of right now is Larissa Pacheco or Pachenko, whatever Pacheco. She fights in PFL right now, but she used to fight in the UFC at 135. But she signed when she was like 21, 22 years old, and she got like her butt handed to her by like Jermaine Durand or me, and I think she lost a couple of fights. So by the time she was 23, her career was done. She fought in Brazil, and like 4 or 5 years later, now she's doing pretty well in PFL. Of course, you know, she has to run to Kayla Harrison again, but that's another issue. But she's a really good fighter who got her. It's just, be careful, Chase Hooper. Be careful, UFC. He's a really good fighter. I don't think he's a champ, but just be careful.
It's easy to get caught in the quicksand when you're kind of on this level this early.
It was Jerome Rivera, Casey. He won the Contender Series. And then he fought Tyson Nam, Francisco Figueiredo, who's Davidson Figueiredo's brother, and then Ode Osborne in 5 months. He's 0-3. And he's 26 right now, and he has a new fight against on the Poirier-McGregor card.
All right.
So he could go 0-4 in less than a year into his UFC debut. Rough times.
Okay, we're almost at hour, so let's just kind of talk faster. I mean, I'll stop blabbing so much.
The PFL is live from Chicago, April 19th, with welterweights and featherweights taking center stage. In the main event, former Bellator welterweight champion Andrei Koreshkov takes on knockout artist Magomed Umalatov. And 2022 PFL world champion Brendan Loughnane looks to start his 2024 off with the bang versus submission specialist Pedro Carvalho. Don't miss the action. Friday, April 19th, live at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on ESPN and ESPN+.
Dan Harden.
This question. Yeah. This isn't a simple one either.
Don Harden, it seems, on Twitter. It seems that Colby Chaos Covington is doing the rounds, accusing Poirier and Usman of some pretty serious things without proof. I'm all for trash talk, but what is the role of an MMA journalist? So, yes, Colby Covington's been doing a lot of interviews, including with our own Mike Heck. You can go watch that interview after we're done with the A-side right here. Sean, I don't know if you watched the interview or saw the clips that are on our Twitter, but he basically brought to light that he's the one that allegedly broke the story of Usman talking around other managers, potentially leaving Ali. And then he also said that Usman is the quote unquote, and this is Colby Covington's phrase, the quote unquote CEO of EPO. And he's doing all the steroids down in preparation for his camp. So, but to answer this question specifically, what is the role of an MMA journalist during interviews like this?
I haven't seen the actual interview, so it's hard for me to speak in context in that regard. So I guess I can address just what Colby's saying.
More of it's just a generalization. You interview a fighter, the fighter says, oh, this fighter does this, this, this. And that's like borderline illegal stuff, you know, or, you know, illegal in the sport. And maybe just Colby accused Dustin of, you know, his charity isn't real. It's a tax write off. This isn't the real guy. That charity is BS, you know, that type of stuff.
See, it's weird, right? Because I think it's one thing if I'm interviewing, I don't know, Kelvin Gastelum, and Kelvin Gastelum starts saying these type of things, I feel like someone like that comes with a certain level of credibility where it's just like, oh, well, that's not really like Kelvin's personality to just make up some stuff. And then I feel like that's a different level of a conversation, a different kind of approach than if it's just a guy like Colby. Because Colby's just chill. Like, they'll just throw stuff out there and see what sticks. Like, it's really difficult for me to believe anything Colby says, because that's just kind of the character and the persona that he's created. Like, he's just this guy who's going to come in and he's going to fire wild shots for 20 minutes during the interview. And half the things he's going to say are ridiculous and half are going to be exaggerated. And you know, like, it's weird with a guy like that, where he is obviously playing a character in terms of policing the interview space. Like, someone like that, you kind of just give him the runway and say, hey, go. And then afterwards you can kind of go back and parse through it, because there is so much there. But
where do we draw the line, though?
I mean, I drew the line with Colby a long time ago. I don't really enjoy much Colby content. I'll be honest. Like it's not my style of how fight promotion goes, but I know that there are people who enjoy it. So certainly, you know, I'm not going to tell them that they're wrong. It's just a personal preference type of thing.
I think back, you know, with the difference between him and Chael is like there was always a sense of humor with Chael. I mean, you know, the whole carrot on the bus thing. Yeah. It was always like you knew that was fake. You knew it was like a story. It was like a funny haha story, you know. But you didn't go, wait a minute. So exactly how long was this stick, Chael? How did this work? You know?
Well, Chael was pure pro wrestling. That was all tongue in cheek. Like you could tell that his tongue was firmly planted in his cheek for all of it. Colby's is much more mean spirited.
That's what I mean.
Like, I'm just going to be as mean as possible.
Like you're attacking the guy's charity, you know, and just saying it's not real.
I mean, let's not forget about his ESPN interview split screen with Usman where he said, go back to your tribe with smoke signals and stuff. Like that is just. That's horrendous. That's horrendous talk right there.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know, Mr. Harden. That's because even like the drug stuff, you know, is he accused of Vittori of EP or of taking steroids? Vittori accused Izzy of taking steroids.
You know, I mean that's just a pretty common.
I feel like we consider in the MMA world we consider that just whatever. You don't like okay, sure, you know, but. Yes, it's that line.
Well, Vittori was suspended for testing positive for a banned substance in the past. I think that's why Izzy was bringing that up. And then remember.
Yeah, but that case was a lot more complex than 100, saying like he was suspended.
No,
like he didn't actually do anything wrong when it comes to
100,
that.
We understand that. But I think in the eyes of fans that don't follow the USADA situation and everything, they just see drug suspension and they just jump to conclusions, which we all know happens. And then Israel Adesanya, of course, had the weird chest thing and everyone was pointing, his fellow fighters were saying steroids, and we all know the situation. But I think that was just also two fighters playing up to the eyes of the fans, like throwing accusations out there. That's different than what Colby Covington was doing.
I will say I'll throw an addendum onto my answer before of what's the role of an MMA journalist. And I think in this regard, if you're going into an interview with Colby, it's essentially, you know, that you're doing some sort of performance art, right? You're doing some sort of act for everybody that's kind of like, hey, this is going to be just a fun, depending on whether you enjoy that type of thing, 20 minutes where lots of stuff might just happen. The role of the journalist, in my opinion, at that point is after the fact, where if you are writing any of that up, or you're putting any of it out there, you have to provide proper context of like, hey, a lot of this isn't true, or hey, here's links to this and this and this of what he's saying, of why this maybe it might not be true, that type of thing. Like you have to provide the full scope of context to this guy's wild accusations and claims. You can't just put them out there like, hey, he says this and then maybe it's true, maybe it's not, who knows.
I want to see someone, especially like at a, like, do you remember were you at the June card, which card would the Colby Covington beat Dos Anjos? I can't remember the exact. I know it was Chicago. I just can't remember the number. But that was when Colby was doing the whole. That was when Colby's whole thing was the Eagles. That was the week the Eagles said no to going to the White House. Kneeling for the flag stuff. And he kept bringing that up. And then a reporter goes, you know, they're not kneeling to disrespect the flag. They're kneeling to protest police brutality. And Colby Covington looked completely caught off guard by someone bringing, like pushing back and not going with the stick and not going with his stick. And then he goes like, yeah, well, it's just disrespectful. And then like the journalist just goes, oh, he doesn't believe anything he says. And he just moved on. He just moved on from that conversation. So it's, but what Sean said, it's not for everyone. It's not for me. So I don't take anything he says overly seriously.
And this is a good segue.
What's up from Daniel Pompilio? What's up with Adesanya humping Costa and grabbing Vittori? Can something be done about it? Is there a rule against it, or can the UFC intervene?
Can something be done about it?
Well, Daniel,
what are you going to want done about it?
Like, well, Daniel,
what was it back in the day? What was the Randy Couture fight where Randy did this?
When Tito Ortiz was threatening with a leg lock, and Vittori was like, Couture was like, good try. Good try. And we're just patting him on the butt because it was like a leg lock from the bottom. And he goes,
yeah,
good try, man. And then Tito's corner was like, he's tapping. He's tapping. And then, that's the Couture thing. But Daniel, this is a sport where grown men strip down to their underwear in a fist fight inside of a cage in front of 20,000 people. I think there's worse things happening than Israel Adesanya kind of having a silly goose time inside the octagon.
Nate Diaz was freaking twerking in the cage. So
Nate Diaz and Leon were throwing the finger at each other.
Can you imagine if that Nate Diaz strategy had actually worked though, where like we have an actual highlight out there where he's like doing that back that ass up bump and then all of a sudden lands like his 1-2 and like actually like that was how we got that crazy last minute was off of something like that, like he'd be even more legendary at that point. Like I don't even know what I was watching.
Derek Lewis tried that against JDS. He like doubled down like in pain from a body shot and then Junior like runs in and then Derek Lewis just like explodes and catches him off guard. So yeah, but to answer this question specifically, there's no rule and nothing will be done about it, nor should it there be done about it, unless someone goes really over the top. But
if the other guy doesn't like it, they're in the middle of a fight.
About
they
it.
Can probably, yeah, about it, yeah, they can do something about it.
That, yeah. Can something be done about it? Yeah. Don't put yourself in a position to get humped by Israel Adesanya in the middle of the octagon on a pay-per-view.
After you talk tons of trash for a long, long time in a really deeply personal way.
Yeah.
After your manager said that, what did he say? That Israel Adesanya had the gay gene and needs to be researched by science. Mm. That's what Paulo Costa's manager said. So yeah. Don't say that. That's worse than what Izzy did.
Anyway. Can there be a rule against it?
Keep it moving.
I love Izzy gets stripped because he humped a fighter during a fight.
Anyway.
Anyway.
We're gonna do rapid fire ones because we've gone a little over.
Let me go to the actually. I got some YouTube comments real quick. Here we go. Oops. Oh, that's too small.
Jessica Crystal Crew, you guys look like cool dudes. Love the energy. Good job. Jessica,
just a couple of cool guys.
Jessica, send Sean some crystals. He needs to. I got mine right here still. Casey, and I know you have yours.
Oh, yeah, I got my. Yeah, everything's Sean right.
I missed this whole crystal era. I missed this whole crystal era. I have no actual concept of what the crystal era was and how magical it might have been.
The crystal era started when.
Oh, my God. Is that a crystal? That's huge.
It's huge. Dude, the crystal council.
So heavy. Like,
the crystal council.
My veins are popping.
Is it just like if you popped that open, it would be like.
We don't know. I have no idea. I don't want to find out. I don't want to break it open. But the Crystal Council sent us all these crystals and sage and everything. It started during the Pete C. Carroll, Jose Young's iteration of the ASI when it was just us two. And Jared Cannonier had just knocked out Jack Hermanson, I think in Copenhagen. And Jared Cannonier was on the ESPN desk on ESPN. And Tyron Woodley goes, "What's that around your neck?" And Jared Cannonier pulled out his pyrite crystal and said it wards off negative energy and this and that on ESPN. And Pete C was absolutely taken aback and had no idea things like that existed. And then a bunch of people tweeted at us about their crystals, including UFC bantamweight Brian Kelleher, Jessica right here, Molly McCann tweeted at us, and so on and so forth. So then it became a running thing. Jessica and various other people sent us crystals. We gave Brian Kelleher a crystal before his fight against Ode Osborne. He asked for one. If you watch the official weigh-ins, you can see Brian Kelleher yell something out to the crowd. He's yelling at me and Pete C to give him a crystal. We gave him a tiger's eye crystal, which is supposed to bring monetary wealth. So if you watch the ceremonial weigh-ins, he gets on the scale and he holds his tiger's eye crystal that we gave him. Less than a couple hours after weighing in, Claudia Gadelha, Alexa Grasso gets pulled from the card. Brian Kelleher versus Ode Osborne was supposed to be on the fight pass prelims. They get elevated to the main card, and Brian Kelleher wins with that guillotine choke and gets $50,000 bonus. So I'm not saying it was the crystal, but it was 100% the crystal. So now we have various other people calling in. We even interviewed Jared Cannonier, and he brought us to his crystal room, which is just pyrite as far as the eye can see. I chatted with him a little bit on Fight Island. He was doing like some ceremony thing inside the octagon on the beach where he would lay all his crystals in the sun and collect their positive energy and this and that. So yeah, there's been a lot of crystal talk. We even gave Pete C a crystal on when we did a preview show, and he went all in on it. So It's been an interesting 12 months with the Crystal Crew. And it was Jared Cannonier was, we called him Captain Crystal for a long time. And then his Twitter kind of became a little out of control for a bit when he was, you know, tweeting a lot of things about a lot of things. And I think I think Jessica says Jairzinho is the new Captain Crystal because he wears the same crystal to every single card that someone gave it to him. And he doesn't know what kind of crystal is because we, of course, Sean, as you know, Journalism Integrity, we did research on it and asked him about it. He doesn't know. But he said he would find out. And that is
what a run.
That is, yeah. So
what a run for the Crystal Crew.
Jessica, send some crystals to Sean. He needs some on his mantle on the back.
Couple more comments before we get out.
Oh, I'm redoing my whole studio. So yeah, I'll put some crystals. I got all sorts of new things coming. So
we, Casey and I both got just, there you go. Noah, man, Suns in four.
Suns in four, boxes. Baby. Let's go. Chris Paul, get back, please. Please, I need you. Oh, this is the year. We're never going to have another chance like this, man. Like, this is, everything is breaking our way in the way that it never does, in the way that it always does for other people and not for us. We're watching it happen. You can't do this to me, Chris Paul. Come back, please. Please believe me.
Let's pray for seven games between Jazz and Clippers and get all the time he needs to come back.
Shaheen.
What?
Okay. You know, all these, like, I get on Dave Doyle about this because he's a big, whatever, Patriots fan. I was like, oh, it's so easy to be a fan of a winning team. I admire you, sir.
Okay, hold on.
Being a fan of a shit
hold
team.
Hold on,
Jose. Jose, no, hey, I know I, what I, you're going to come I,
No, I just want to. I want to defend. I want to defend Doyle for 1 second for being because Doyle. When I grew up, and so Dave Doyle's obviously much older than me. When I was growing up, the New England Patriots were the worst team in football. So you can tell a Patriots fan from that era and a Patriots fan this current era.
You know.
And hold on. Yes, I understand.
Every team sucks at some point.
I understand Sean is a Patriots fan in Arizona, but I'm just saying you can really tell a fan like my dad. He grew up when the year I was born, the Patriots were 1-15. Like they were historically bad until 1999. Yes, they went to a Super Bowl, but they got cooked up 20, by Brett Favre
21 years ago.
The Patriots had Tom Brady for 20 years.
Before Chase Hooper was born.
Yeah, look, it's to the point. Yeah, go ahead.
All I'm gonna say is that the Suns, before all of this happened over the last 11 years, were historically great and historically unlucky. We were the fourth winningest franchise in NBA history, and we're the only one, I think, in that whole like top five or top 10 to not win a title. There was a giant list that I won't go through right now of just like, here's the unlucky thing that happened on this season, that the reason why we didn't win a title. Here's the unlucky thing that this happened here. Suspension, injury, all of this stuff. It was nonstop my entire life. And then all of a sudden, we just became abject trash. And not even just like the fun kind of trash. It was like the kind of trash where you're not even doing one thing or the other. You're kind of in this middle zone where you're not like tanking and drafting these good prospects who are giving you hope for the future, but you're also not like, you don't have anything to look for in terms of future, past, anything. You're kind of trotting out Isaiah Cannon and Tyler Uless and Mike James and all of these ridiculous draft and Marquise Chris and Dragon Bender and Josh Jackson and just like this parade of endless bullshit that wasn't anything. I watched so many seasons where I watched 90% of the games of 19 wins out of 82 games. And then all of a sudden we fall four spots in the draft because somebody jumps us. And it's just it was the worst type of misery ever where you just feel that this is never going to end. And you don't know why you're wasting all your time on this. And you have no sense of anything when it comes to like what actual basketball looks like at a certain point. Like I don't really watch a lot of other teams. So like for a long time, basketball was just an ugly sport to me because I didn't actually understand what good basketball looked like. And now all of a sudden to have this, to randomly have this come into our lives, really since the bubble last year, where all of a sudden we're 8-0 in that bubble. And ever since then, we're basically the best team in the whole NBA when it comes to records. This is genuinely the wildest thing I have ever experienced as an adult man who likes sports. And I never saw it coming. I am enjoying every second of it. I've been to like five playoff games at this point. Jose and I have already started conversations about potentially going to Utah for game one to make assholes out of ourselves if that's the series. I'm trying to enjoy this as much as possible. I just bought $300 of Suns in Four merch yesterday. Like, you don't understand. I don't know that I'll ever experience this again in my entire life. And all I ever wanted was just once. Just give me one. Like, my whole life. Like, just I'll live the rest of my life with none if you just give me one, because I don't even understand what one would feel like. This felt like it. Like, this feels like the chance, man. Everything is breaking our way. Every possible, like I was afraid of Brooklyn, and now maybe Brooklyn's still in it, so, like, who knows? But, like, it just feels like things are breaking our way in the way that they never do, in sort of like a 2011 Mavericks type of situation.
Yeah.
And I am so, so trying to not just go, like, get myself too up for it, where it's just like, I'm just going to have the worst heartbreak of my life. But there is a 90% chance that at some point during this run, maybe after a playoff game, like, Phoenix is just going to burn to the ground, because the whole state feels like I just did. Like, there's a billion people in the state who could just make that exact same rant. And at some point, you're just going to see me outside of this arena in the middle of a riot, flipping burning cop cars with my shirt off. Like, it's just like, this is the inevitable end to this. If we win this title, I'm going to be gone off the face of the earth for like 2 weeks and wake up in some back alley in Thailand. Like, I'm not going to understand what happened 2 weeks of my life. It's going to be ridiculous. And I just want that. I just want to feel that once. Just once. And
as someone who didn't grow up in Arizona like Sean did, Phoenix Suns actually had good fans even when they were bad. Like, I've never really met a diehard Diamondbacks fan. You don't meet a lot of diehard Cardinals fans. When you go to those games, it's like 75% for the other team and then like 25% for the home team. Suns fans, to their credit, have been a very vocal and very, like, you've all seen the video of that, of what's her name at the city council meeting, whatever. Like, Suns have great fans, and they stuck with this team when they were trash. Also, I know a lot of you tweeted at me when the Suns won, when they beat the Lakers and they swept the Nuggets. Send all that to Sean, because as you just heard, he's an actual diehard Suns fan. I like the Suns by proxy after living here for 10 years. Send all that positivity to Sean. He needs it.
I'm just saying, we're going to Utah game one. It's going to happen.
All I'm saying
I'm ready to go, man. Once that series is over, I'm buying tickets.
All I'm saying, Sean, it feels better. I admire fans of shitty sports teams, because that takes commitment, and it feels better when they do win. Being a fan of a winner, that's easy. Being a fan of a shit team, that's where you go.
When my grandmother saw the Boston Red Sox win their first World Series in 2004 after 86 years, I have never seen a happier human being, because she was like, she missed the last Red Sox World Series, obviously, and then she died a year later, and she even was like, I can die happy now. And I was like, I have no idea what that feels like, because I was 13 when the Red Sox won the World Series. I have no idea what it's like to be part of a team that didn't win a World Series for 86 years. So yeah, good on you,
dude. When the Astros won their World Series, I feel that moment. I can still remember that moment. So
I can't, last thing on this, I can't tell you the amount of times that I've had conversations with buddies over the last 10-15 years where we're just, you know, sitting in a garage hanging out at 2 a.m and it's just like, I am genuinely afraid that I will die and all of this will have been for nothing. And I got nothing out of this. Like, nothing positive came to me for all of this stupid time and energy that I invested in this crappy franchise. And finally, we might have this one shot. I need it so bad.
Suns in four, moral of the story.
Suns in four,
anyway,
baby.
What a fantastic way to end this. From Guilherme Cruz, Brazilian MMA media extraordinaire. This Shaheen guy is a handsome dude. Thank you, Guilherme.
He's a handsome dude. He's like 6'5", too.
Anyway, we'll have to have Guilherme back on the show, because he's playing dad now. So he's kind of, he has his handful of the new young one. But anyway, this has been the Outside Live Chat here on MMAfighting.com. This has been Jose. Sean, do you have anything to say before we close out, or did you just go on your full rant and that's how you want to end it?
Nah, man. I mean, I appreciate having you back, or having you back. You having me back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
It was so much fun being back on the ground with you last week, and I'm so excited for the future of MMA fighting and what we're going to do here. We got big plans. I can't wait for it. It has been an honor and a pleasure. I'm sure we will do this again. Suns in four, baby.
Suns in four. Casey, anything you want to say from America? Is that a Super Junior? Is that a Super Cup shirt? Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I know. Just be nice to your fellow neighbors and, have fun out there. Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole. What a way to end it. You can find this on Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Periscope, Facebook Live, and of course, you come back here and watch it on YouTube. And with that, we'll see you next Wednesday.
Happy birthday, AK.
Oh, boy.
You're listening to the Vox Media Podcast Network.
The PFL is live from Chicago, April 19th, with welterweights and featherweights taking center stage. In the main event, former Bellator welterweight champion Andrei Kereshkov takes on knockout artist Magomed Umalatov. And 2022 PFL world champion Brendan Loughnane looks to start his 2024 off with the bang versus submission specialist Pedro Carvalho. Don't miss the action. Friday, April 19th, live at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on ESPN and ESPN+.